I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Ben Kamen, author of the new book, The Blessing of Sorrow, Turning Grief into Healing. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinshinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We've been exploring Jewish learning over these hot weeks of summer, taking some time here on Two Jewish to look at the parts of our own tradition that many of us don't really know so well. The last couple of Two Jewish shows, I suggested reading the Torah and the Prophets in English, that is, the first two sections of the Jewish Bible, the Tanakh, which, unfortunately, most Jews haven't really read through in a long time, or at all. Just 15 minutes a day of dedicated reading of these classic texts will change your understanding of Judaism, I promise. And, well, your understanding of religion and quite possibly all literature, and benefit you nearly as much as listening to Two Jewish does each week. Having covered the Torah and the Prophets, this morning I want to suggest a different approach to getting to know the third and final section of this most important Jewish book of all time, the Hebrew Bible. Yes, it's even more significant than Portnoy's Complaint, believe it or not. For the third section of the Bible, what we Jews call the writings, the Ketuvim of the Tanakh, what some people still call the Old Testament, I suggest starting with what are known as the Five Scrolls, or the Chamesh Megillot, books that are each quite different and extremely interesting to read and not very long. Now, you can, of course, just plunge in and start by reading the first book of the writings, the Ketuvim, Psalms, which is 150 chapters long and filled with poetic hymns to God, both positive and challenging. You could then proceed to read the second text in Ketuvim, Proverbs, which is shorter but still long and really pithy and preachy. And you can then move on to the third book of the writings, Job, which is magnificent, but pretty darn depressing. Or, instead, you can read the diverse and fascinating books that come next in the Ketuvim, the Five Scrolls, respectively the Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, and Esther. Each of these is incredible in its own way, and each, also in its very own way, is a really good read. And each one of these Megillot, these so-called scrolls, is pretty short. To fully appreciate them, you'll want to know a little background about each book. For example, the Song of Songs is a sexy love poem. Ruth is a fable about kindness. Lamentations comes out of the agony of loss. Ecclesiastes is amazingly beautiful writing about wisdom. And Esther is an incredibly dramatic adventure story full of plot twists and turns. But every one of these five books stands on its own, and each can be read easily in an hour or less. When you take the time to read these extraordinary texts, you cannot help but find yourself admiring the diversity and beauty of the Hebrew Bible and its human depth and wisdom. For the Tanakh, while a seminal religious text, also spans the spectrum of forms of literary expression and runs the full range of human emotion and experience. Do take the time to read a little of this amazing book. Doesn't take a lot of time, really. Less than watching an episode of The Voice, say, or a rerun of Game of Thrones, or two episodes of The Big Bang Theory. But the Bible is actually much better than any of those. When you take the time to do a little summer exploration of Jewish tradition, I promise it will reward you in every way. Play us in this morning. Here's a selection from a text in the Ketuvim, those same writings from the Bible. It's from the book Song of Songs, Dodi Li. This is a setting by cantor Steve Scher, as sung by him, Ricky Lippitz, and Joe Black, well, a few years back before they were cantor and rabbi, respectively.
Dodi Li, shanim todim mizot
That was Steve Scherer's setting of Dodi Li from the Song of Songs in the Hebrew Bible. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Ben Kamen, has written a new book on the way we experience grief and mourning. Find out what has changed, why it's so important to explore these issues fully, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Ben Kamen has a new book out, The Blessing of Sorrow, Turning Grief into Healing. He is an author of many works, has a Doctor of Divinity from Hebrew Union College, one of my alma maters, and is a nationally known clergyman, teacher, counselor, and author. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning, and it's wonderful to be here with you. Thank you, Sam.
So why a book about sorrow as a blessing?
You know, it's something that I've really come to realize in many powerful ways and some extensively painful ways. And having, like most people, suffered a number of losses along the way, including, you know, death, end of a marriage, losing a job, all these things. And I just have come to realize how precious all of this these challenging moments are. They're teaching moments, because in each case, as I believe it's true for most people, if you become aware of it, you actually get stronger, because life progresses and more things happen. And as I write in the book, grief is a great teacher, because it can send us back to bless the living. People are changed by it. Not all, but many. And I think that my big concern relating to this is the fact that it's clear to me after 40 years so far of being blessed to do this kind of work here in the United States, that so many Americans just simply struggle with the fact that they need to grieve, and they defer it. They sanitize it in terms of kind of parties and receptions. I'm not upset with anybody. I just want to be helpful. And in short, they simply do not confront the reality and the responsibilities of the burden of grief.
It's almost as though we have a denial complex with loss. You know, the first time I saw Celebration of Life, and I thought, gosh, what's that? And realized, well, that was a funeral or a memorial. But it was all happy and pleasant and charming memories. And that's not a very Jewish way to approach it. And so maybe that's my challenge with it. What do you think about that?
It is becoming more and more of the Jewish approach to dealing with it, because I just deal with so many situations. And right. And I always sympathetic. This is very important to me, and I do believe in serving people at their point of need. I mean, when someone dies, it's not necessarily the time to start teaching religious doctrine or
theology, right? Exactly.
I mean, they're not equipped to do that, and it's not, you know, you can't blame them for that. So they often have succumbed to the prevailing, and the Jews, our fellow Jews, we often succumb to the prevailing American cultural tendency to try and recycle this into a great social event. And I say this with concern. I don't think anybody is evil. I'm sure they. People love or at least cared enough about the deceased. But, you know, funerals are for the living, it's been said so often. And I think that the party that needs the most cathartic work needs intervention and help, whether formally or not, whatever they need. And not doing that kind of stuff actually set them up for something I experienced 2-3 years ago, and that is, maybe this is an extreme example, you literally fall into depression, because that deferred grief, it doesn't actually leave your body psyche. It has to be channeled through your heart, your soul, your lungs, everything, because it's a severe blow. It's a natural occurrence, but it's the most difficult thing, obviously, that we deal with in losing someone very special in all categories.
We will continue to explore this grief and loss and turning grief into healing with Rabbi Ben Kamen. We'll return in a moment here on Two Jewish, his book, The Blessing of Sorrow. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So, Gaza has been in the news, and it has been not positive news about Israel in terms
right.
of the way it's perceived.
Right.
I want to talk a little bit, because when I talk about Gaza, I'm an American Jew. I'm supportive of Israel, but that doesn't mean that I've had the same experiences that you have or that other Israelis have had. Tell a little bit about your experience of how the events in Gaza over the last few months have been perceived here, and your thoughts on it.
First, I got to start by saying that it's hard. It's really difficult. You know, when you wake up in the morning and either you read a newspaper or you listen to a radio, you watch TV, and you're accused. You know, you are accused. I mean, your people are accused, and accused as murderers and someone who commits a massacre and things like that. And I know that the soldiers in the IDF are me, you, are people. And the people that I know, the people that I worked with, worked for me, people that grew up with me are good people. And it's hard when you know the reality, where when you're a soldier in the IDF, morality is very important. And before you are handed a gun, the first thing you do is you learn about rules of engagements. You learn about what you must do as a human being not to hurt civilians, to hurt only those who want to hurt you. Every time I was based as a soldier and as a commander, there were rules that I had to study and I had to pass a test. And every region had, you know, different rules and different realities. You know, if it was Gaza, I was in Gaza within Gaza, not on the border. And if it's West Bank, or you call it Judea Samaria, I was in. In Hebron, I was in. And even now, I know in person. They're former soldiers of mine. I mean, they're not former soldiers. They're former students. Now they're soldiers. Here in the United States, either Jewish students, Israeli, American students who made Aliyah to Israel. Some serve as regular soldiers. Some are already officers in special units. And I know them. And I know for a fact that when you're attacked, you don't just shoot to kill. You want to make sure that you do the right thing. And as a sharpshooter, you have an earpiece that tells you, your direct commander, if you have a green light or a red light. And I know for a fact that even though the headquarters said, shoot, you have a green light, if the sharpshooter saw that he doesn't have 100%, you know, shot, which
target,
is in the leg, not in the heart and not in the chest, then he will not shoot. And another thing is that we live here in the States, and you know, I served four Jewish day schools as an educator. Lived nearby; they were always in good neighborhoods. My neighbors didn't have a conflict with me, and if it was a conflict, it wasn't a violent one.
Right.
You know, we always respected one another, and we spoke like you and I speak now.
Right.
It's not the reality with Gaza. We have Hamas, who morning and night sends his people to kill us. And when they say over the radio, we want to penetrate into Israel, we want to go to villages and kibbutzim, which are 2 meters away, and we want to take your heart out, kill all of you. So what we were supposed to do, let them in?
Right. It's such a painful time. Maybe we'll continue this a little bit next week.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Amir.
Thank you.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Jewish traders who traveled on the extensive trade routes that ran from Western Europe all the way to China throughout the Middle Ages, at a time when it took 3, 4, 5 years to make that journey. There were also permanent Jewish communities in all those places. And you were explaining how that was facilitated by the Mongol Empire, you know, Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan and all of the Mongol barbarians who actually weren't so barbaric, in how they figured out how to create a really a functional and effective financial system and travel system that allowed it to happen. Why did our perceptions, which were mixed even in the Middle Ages, change to such an incredibly negative one?
Well, that's a good question. But first, your listeners might want to hear about the letters of credit that existed even before the Mongol times,
sure,
which were precursors to something that was bigger, better, and more efficient ultimately, like don't leave home without it.
Credit cards.
But the
traveler's checks and then
those
credit cards.
Letters that you had mentioned
right,
earlier
commenda,
from your senior
the
thesis.
The commenda contracts,
right.
Yeah, which were developed so that if you were a Jew who came from Spain, let's say, whether it a Christian or a Muslim community, didn't matter, you got a commenda contract, you had a letter of credit, and that was honored in Jewish communities throughout the route. And so if you needed to draw specie cash in the local money, whatever it was, or gold or silver, you would have this contract and you would make an agreement that it would be repaid when you returned or through another letter of credit. They were exchangeable. And it was not nearly as well developed as what we have today, but it really created the beginnings of what became international finance. It was followed by a Muslim thing called an ICSA, which was also a kind of letter of credit, and then later by this Muslim system of exchange, so that you didn't have to carry cash, you weren't subject to robbery in the same way. And if you, when you came to a community that honored it, which would be pretty much any serious Jewish community, you were okay.
Right. And from a historian's point of view, this is interesting because these early forms of letters of credit, which developed into the early Mongol form of a credit card, which was much more universal, financed the global expansion of trade that eventually underwrote the Renaissance and all the cultural developments and the end of the Middle Ages, really, and the beginning of modern times happened because of this expansion of global trade.
And our current prosperity. I mean, all financial development.
Industrial revolution.
Whatever, commercial revolution. Right. Cryptocurrency today.
Hard to overstate the importance of this. Right. Now, to come back to your question of why did our perception of the Mongols change, at the risk of oversimplifying, victors write history. So in the end, when the Brits and the French and the Portuguese and the Spanish wanted to establish world empires, they had to posit a reason that gave them the right to dominate, quote-unquote, inferior races, people of other colors, other belief systems, non-Christians, non-whites. So in order to do that, they first had to discredit the Mongols, who had clearly been viewed as highly civilized and innovative and progressive. So they started demonizing the Mongols and the Mongol hordes and the Mongol barbarians, and they called babies with Down syndrome Mongoloids. And we eventually got a whole series of negative associations with the Mongols that laid the foundation for the idea that it was right and natural for white Christian Brits to dominate India, which was far larger because they were non-Christian and non-white. And this laid some kind of ideological foundation for the creation of all the great imperialist empires. And it's all very questionable, to put it mildly.
Fascinating. What was it Disraeli said supposedly in the House of Lords when he was when they were making anti-Semitic comments? While my ancestors were creating the Talmud, your ancestors were painting themselves blue and running around naked. So, all right. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So you guys have now had a real full experience, including a lot of outdoor experience here in America, hiking and taking kids out and being on Mount Lemmon and places like that. What's the difference between experiencing nature in a gigantic country like the United States of America and a small country like Israel?
So actually this year I got to think about it a lot because Chen and I were always trying to explore and see other things and make the best out of this year in terms of traveling in our free time, which was kind of limited, but we spent every single second of it. And
you worked hard, there's no doubt.
Yeah, so I thought of that, and we drove to California, and I drove to the White Sands in New Mexico, and we both drove up in Arizona. And I think that something I realized this year is that for us, it's kind of like Israel, it's kind of like an island. Because all of our neighbors are not very friendly, and so we can't just like come into Egypt and say like, "Hey, what's up?
Oh,
want
to
see your pyramids?
Let's go drive to Sharm el Sheikh, or let's go to Giza. Oh, yeah. I want to go to Petra today. I'll just drive across the border into Jordan."
So Petra is one of the exceptions, but actually driving to Lebanon and Jordan
Syria,
and Syria, and it's impossible. And really looking at this map this year, I did my geography work this year, and I looked and it's like kind of possible to even drive from Israel to Europe if you really want to through Turkey. And it's really cool the places that Israelis could actually reach if we were in peace with our neighbors. And it just made me feel like we're missing out on so much culture and nature and just people. And it's kind of a bummer that we don't really get to drive and cross the border to the country next to us and see what's going on, like America, which is just like a huge place where you can go up there and see this huge mountain and this lake and that white sands.
Right. Or if you want to drive to, I don't know, Montana or South Dakota and see Mount Rushmore, you get
in
a car.
That, yeah.
Yeah, like if you lost your phone there.
Right.
It's my dream to get to Mount Rushmore, and Chen is always laughing at me.
Yeah, you know, I will tell you, for 15 minutes, Mount Rushmore is amazing.
Yeah, been there, done that. Speaking of driving to the Grand Canyon. Oh.
Well, now, you know, there are people who think highly of the Grand Canyon, and I'm not sure.
It's really nice. It's just, I feel like if we don't hike it or, like, go in it, it just kind of, like, Wow, that's really beautiful. And then it's like,
it is true. You drive there, you look at it for a little bit. You drive to another place, you look at it. It's like, okay, so what's next?
Yeah. Also, so, I feel like the Grand Canyon is like very large, and we don't have the depth perception as humans to really get it. I liked Horseshoe Bend better because it's like tiny.
Very nice. I want to add one thing, just another thought, which is one of the challenges for Israel that people don't really perceive. And you mentioned it's like being on an island. I think about something like the World Cup, which is, you know, ongoing. And Israel has to compete against European teams to try to make it to the World Cup, which is nearly impossible. All the best teams are from Europe, nearly.
We're also ranked number 93 in the world. Just realized that today.
In soccer, yeah.
93 in soccer. So
that's before the United States.
Yes, higher than the U.S. if Israel was actually in a Middle East bracket or an Asia bracket, they would have a far better chance of making it to the World Cup.
Probably, yeah,
but teams won't play against them.
Exactly. So it, you know, also, same goes for the Eurovision, where we won the Eurovision. So according to the rules of the competition, the next year it's supposed to be hosted in Israel.
Right.
But since Israel is such a controversial place,
we'll see what happens. It has hosted it before. I hope it happens again. Folks, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Izzy goes to meet his new son-in-law-to-be, an Orthodox yeshiva bachar named Benji. He says to Benji, "So new, tell me, Benji, my boy, what do you do?" "I study Torah," Benji replies. "Now, Benji, you're going to marry my daughter. How are you going to support her?" "No problem," says Benji. "I study Torah, and God will provide." Benji says, "Izzy, I know you're observant, Orthodox, but kosher food is very expensive. How will you manage?" "No problem," says Benji. "I study Torah, and God will provide." "But you'll have many children, God willing, and day school's expensive. How will you educate them?" asks Izzy. "No problem," says Benji. "I study Torah, and God will provide." Izzy returns home from meeting his upcoming son-in-law. His wife anxiously asks him, "What is Benji like?" "Well," says Izzy, "very nice boy. I just met him. He already thinks I'm God." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. Korach chronicles the greatest rebellion in the whole Torah, the palace revolt of the Levite named Korach and his 400 followers against the divinely ordained leadership of his fellow Levites, Moses and Aaron. As so often seems to be the case, we Jews are our own worst enemies. The result of this insurrection is disastrous, at least for the rebels. The earth opens, Korach and all of his misguided followers are swallowed up, never to be heard from again. By tradition, the rebellion of Korach is the absolute worst revolt of its sort in all of Jewish history. But this is hardly the first rebellion of the Israelites against Moses' leadership, and it certainly will not be the last. In a couple of weeks, the Torah portion of Pinchas will conclude yet another episode of Insider Revolution, that one solved at the point of a spear. And the rebellions against Moses and God have been continuous. The criticism on the very shore of the Red Sea, the Golden Calf episode, the intense unhappiness of the children of Israel throughout their peregrinations in the desert, right up to last week's story of the failed spies in Shlach Lecha. Our ancestors had a very bad habit of constantly becoming dissatisfied and continuously trying to overthrow the proper order. Whoever was in charge got the brunt of the criticism and received the lion's share of the hostility. That tendency has remained a particularly Jewish one throughout our long history. While we joke about the stereotype of two Jews having three opinions, and four synagogues, by the way, the truth is that our ancient heritage is a contentious one. If we weren't rebelling against God and Moses, we were fighting for control of the monarchy, or against Philistines, Babylonians, Greeks, or Romans. And when actual armed insurrection was beyond us, we engaged in intellectual debates so intense they bordered on warfare. From the endless, detailed Talmudic arguments to the political infighting of the Zionists, to the Jewish socialists against the Jewish communists against the Jewish anarchists, there is a long and rich and highly developed tradition of Korachism. Since Korach is considered to be the worst of these, I wondered if there's any clue in the Hebrew of his name. The root Korach has a few other meanings. One is to cut or shear things, to slice. And certainly rebellion is a cutting gesture. Another meaning of Kufresh Chet is ice or cold, like Kerach, to chill or freeze, again a kind of reflection of emotional distance and hostility. Put those together, to cut and make cold, and you come up with, well, cold cuts. Very Jewish. My favorite Korach translation, though, is the meaning baldness, Kareach. This seems to indicate that a lack of hair might make somebody untrustworthy. My apologies on behalf of the Hebrew language to all bald people who rightfully resent this assertion. In defense, I have to say that some of my best friends are bald, and there's nothing implied here about hair pieces to remedy the baldness, also implying a rebellious nature. Our Midrash provides another clue. By rabbinic tradition, Korach is considered to have been a very wealthy man, a kind of Jewish Croesus, the Rothschild, the Bill Gates, the Jeff Bezos of the Sinai Desert Israelites. There's a Hebrew slang term, Otsrot Korach, the treasures of Korach, basically means somebody is filthy rich. Somehow, Korach's wealth is associated with a tendency to revel in rebellion, a willingness to say and do anything, regardless of truth or decency, because his money can insulate him from the consequences of his vile statements and actions. Let's see now. Rebellion against God's appointed leaders comes from a coldness of heart and a desire to cut. It reflects a paucity of the insulating calm of natural hair and is inflamed by the financial means to support a truly dangerous rebellion. I'm not sure that our little Hebrew excursion has provided us with totally useful insights, but maybe. One thing, however, does emerge from Korach, the plain truth that leading Jews has never been an easy task. Important, rewarding, ethically essential, but never, ever easy. It is true that Shvertz Zayin Ayid, it's hard to be a Jew, but it is even harder to be a Jewish leader. And so I wonder, why would intelligent, caring, reasonable Jews wish to take on such a responsibility? What is there about the opportunity to make this commitment that attracts talented people with other things to do in life so that they spend time and effort in this contentious arena? Why would somebody want to engage in the constant give and take, the automatic Jewish flow of criticism and critique that aims itself at any and every leader of substance and integrity? Perhaps the answer is to be found in our Torah portion. Not so much in the desire to see one's enemies swallowed up whole by the earth before everybody's eyes, although that is attractive. No, it's in the understanding, as the defeat of Korach ultimately confirms, that while everyone is holy in this community of priests, legitimate, principled, selfless, honest leadership with integrity is necessary for us to achieve holiness collectively. We Jews need direction and organization, and the practical details of everyday functionality must be taken care of in order for us to be able to grow spiritually. What distinguishes Moses from those who rebel against him, like Korach, is his humble desire to do God's will, to further the cause of oneness and holiness in the world. What Moses teaches us is that conflicts are not the goal. It is what happens after the resolution of conflict that defines us and our true value in the world. May the Holy One bless all of us with the wisdom to know that our path lies not with Korach, no matter his wealth and rebellious qualities, but with Moses, and therefore with God. When we return on to Jewish, our guests, the remarkable musicians behind the outstanding bluegrass group Nefesh Mountain, will explain what it is about this very American music that expresses Jewish themes and ideas so beautifully. Find out from Eric Lindberg and Donnie Zasloff how they make it all work when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
As the controversy over the U.S. government separating immigrant children from parents continues to grow, opposition to this misguided policy now spans the full American Jewish world. The Orthodox Union joined an open letter signed by 26 other Jewish organizations opposing separation of migrants' families at the border. The decision to sign the letter came just days after the Orthodox Union, an important umbrella Orthodox group, hosted Attorney General Jeff Sessions at its annual conference in Washington, D.C., where he spoke to a friendly crowd about protecting religious liberty for houses of worship. In May, Sessions' Justice Department instituted the policy to separate migrant families after they crossed the U.S. border illegally. OU officials were assailed on social media and in a petition organized by the liberal rabbinic human rights group Trua for hosting Jeff Sessions and replied that they brought up the immigration issue with him privately. One day after hosting Sessions, the Orthodox Union released a statement criticizing Trump's separation policy. Under the policy implemented in recent months, every illegal migrant who crosses the U.S. border is prosecuted and detained, so-called zero tolerance. Because children cannot be prosecuted with adults, they are reclassified as unaccompanied minors and taken away, either to mass children's shelters, sometimes in converted old Walmarts, or to foster homes. Critics say forcibly separating parents and children is traumatizing and draconian. Sessions says it's a necessary measure to enforce border security. This policy undermines the values of our nation and jeopardizes the safety and well-being of thousands of people, the Jewish open letter says. As Jews, we understand the plight of being an immigrant, fleeing violence and oppression. We believe the United States is a nation of immigrants, and how we treat the stranger reflects on the moral values and ideals of this nation. The letter, signed by 26 national Jewish organizations, including the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the JCPA, and HIAS, urges the administration to immediately rescind the zero-tolerance policy and uphold the values of family unity and justice on which our nation was built. Among the signers of the letter are the leading organizations of the conservative, reform, and reconstructionist movements. The addition of the Orthodox Union, the OU, means that the top representative bodies of all four major American Jewish denominations have come out against the policy. It is rare that the OU, which generally takes conservative political positions, agrees with the other three movements on a matter of domestic government policy. Religious groups across the spectrum, Jewish and not, have opposed the policy of the government, and the OU is among the most recent conservative religious organizations to oppose it. It has been criticized recently by the Southern Baptist Convention, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the Reverend Franklin Graham, the late Billy Graham's son, not to mention Laura Bush and, well, everyone in America who has a conscience. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guests this morning, Rabbi Ben Kamen's new book is called The Blessing of Sorrow, Turning Grief into Healing. Rabbi Kamen has written, I guess it's 11 books now, right, Ben?
Nobody's counting, but this is my 12th.
12th book. This is the 12th. Almost bar mitzvah time. He has served congregations around the country as well as in Canada and has been a counselor and worked with people in a variety of counseling settings for, you mentioned something like 40 years.
40 years this year.
Mazel tov.
Thank you.
I want to come back to something we began to discuss a little bit. You know, the Jewish process of grieving is very structured. We're supposed to have, you're not even officially a mourner until the body is buried, and we do that as quickly as possible. You have 7 days of Shiva, intense mourning, where you let people come and express their condolences or not, and you're not supposed to go to work and such. You have a 30-day Shloshim period, a year of mourning to complete the process. I know that you've noticed this, as I have. Over the years, Shiva became not 7 days for people, but 3 days. Funerals were deferred for various reasons. People embraced the notion of cremation because it was less expensive, and then they didn't necessarily go ahead with a funeral. A lot of Jewish practices have kind of moved away from traditional practices. To me, that's not for the better, because I think people then don't go through that process you talked about earlier in the show about really grieving so that they can heal.
Yeah, all that you say is true, except I respectfully will note that actually most Jews are not applying those of structures and processes.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they can't grieve properly. Now, I'm a rabbi. I endorse and support what Judaism has to offer. I mean, Judaism has been a blessing for me, since I'm actually privileged to teach it to wonderful people who have experienced it. So, I understand that. I'm responding to what I've noticed, and because I think grief is an immediate issue, even if they do go through those motions sometimes, the atmosphere, for example, in a Shiva house, all well-meaning, and I have visited many, sometimes just is not conducive to allowing the grieving parties to be themselves. And I talk about this a lot in the book, and I'll just give you a quick example. For example, when somebody comes to visit and it's just rather annoying, and because people can do that. What happened? How did he die? What, was she sick for a long time? I mean, people who make irresponsible comments in other places are not going to change their personality and get the program when they come to a Shiva house. And that just is, it happened when my father died, and I deal with my father's death quite a bit in this book, because that was also some 40 plus years ago. I remember a guy came at it, I was in Cincinnati where I grew up, and a guy comes in, and he's one of the leaders of the Jewish Community Center, where I would always hang out. And my father happened to die very, very young, 45. That's a massive sudden heart attack. So not everybody even knew what had happened. So this guy comes in. He's not family. He's well-meaning. He committed a mitzvah by coming into our home. But there was a lull in the conversations, and my young mother is suffering and crying, and my baby sister and my younger brother. And so he looks at me and he blurts out, "So what exactly happened to your father?" And I discovered, this is a learning experience, that I was really angry about that, and I found it very intrusive. And frankly, there's a Bill of Mourners' Rights, in a way. You don't have to put up with a person doing that to you, because this is, frankly, your extraordinarily important time, and there's sanctity in your recovery. Somebody else very graciously asked this gentleman to take his leave. There's also the issue in Shiva houses, and you'll notice none of these have to do with the extraordinarily psychologically intuitive practices of the Jewish community, even if they are modified here and there. But still, you need something to structure it with. But, people, they talk to you, they ask you questions, they bring you food, and most of them are wonderfully intended. But I want to, and I write this, I want to express to anyone that when you are in grief, if you have people over, or if you're in a social celebration of some kind, and you're tired, and you're exhausted, and you can't take the questioning anymore, and you can't put on a happy face, you're not there to entertain, socially entertain people. They're in service to you. And some of them do it well, and some of them do it less well. So you can get up and say, you know what, I just need to go upstairs. I'm tired. I'll maybe go to bed for the night. It's okay. Because you have to do self-care. It's the highest form of self-care in this grieving process. And it is completely disheveled, so to speak, by these intrusions that are increasingly a problem, because, like everything else in America, which is a youth culture, a fun culture, a sports culture, a culture that does not particularly feel comfortable with death, although it's the one thing everybody shares, which is almost a cliche to say, but you can. There are nuances here. So I don't mind if people have a Shiva for 3 days rather than 7. In other words, I will not judge them. I want to help them. And I think another key aspect of this socialization process that occurs during a time of grief is for everyone to understand that the worst thing to do, the last thing they should do, is to offer a judgment. Why aren't your mirrors covered? Why aren't this? Those questions are not pertinent. A decision was made not to do this and not to. It's frankly, with due respect to my holy and sacred religion, these are not as important as the cure, the healing recovery of a person who's grieving. These are structural things invented by people. they work sometimes, but they don't work sometimes. It doesn't make somebody un-Jewish if they don't work.
So going to the larger question of grieving, sometimes it seems to me that we have a great deal of difficulty dealing with death because, of course, we're afraid of our own mortality. How many people really struggle just because they don't want to admit that there's an end for themselves?
Well, I think that's you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's the issue. It's a problem that I want to deal with. You know, when you live, please God, 70, 80, 90 years in a culture where a skin cream to help you look younger, supposedly, is more significant than, you know, what's happening in the schools. In your, I mean, it's unbelievable how much vanity there is and narcissism, and it's become a natural part of American society. So the last thing we want to think about is death and dying. And we relegate it sometimes, even before death, the process of placing a parent or a grandparent in a hopefully, you know, a good and responsible nursing home or a residence of any kind. That's not necessarily a bad thing, because sometimes the issues that they bring to us with their malady are a little bit too difficult for us to manage. And so we can turn it over to professionals and nurses and to all kinds of very, very committed working people who staff these places. But we can't let's leave them there and have them, you know, eventually die among strangers. I'm not saying this is a regular thing, but it happens enough. And grieving people or about to be grieving people have responsibility. They have to understand that the dying are still living as long as they are still here. And that they want to be heard if they're able to talk. And you don't have to come into a situation at a hospital bed or, you know, someone's home or wherever it is and just fumble and think about really clever things to say. Believe me, I'm not being in any way sardonic. On the contrary, I just really have seen a lot of stuff. Most of it great, very tender, but sometimes people, you don't have to. You ask a person who's dying of cancer, well, how are you today? You know, they don't, that's not that helpful. I heard one woman that was in the room with a congregant visiting someone. The person who was ailing, she kind of stood up in her bed and said, well, how do you think I am today? What kind of question is that? I said, more power to you. And she, the patient, who eventually died, thank God, peacefully, was really the catalyst and the teacher in that moment. And it taught me a lot, too. So, depending on the person, the sick person's personal theological orientation, just play to that. And just ask people, sit down and say, what I always do is simply say, I've been thinking a lot about you. That's all you have to say. And it may be a silence after that. Silence has its own eloquence. But I tell you, in most cases, then people really begin to talk and share. And they don't want to be interrupted. They want to be heard.
Ben, you talk a fair amount in your book about life after death and people's perceptions. How important is that for some people to believe there's an eternal life, that there's a continuity for those they love?
I don't think it's extremely important to people until they deal with the coming or the actual death of someone close to them. And I do actually believe that we do not know if there is something beyond what we see here or not. I don't think we should be, during a eulogy time or a comfort time, exclaim, they're in God's hands and all these kinds of things, because this is an event that has theological structure, but at the end it's very personal. It's not really, you know, an ecclesiastic event. Having said that, I have personally that. I mean, I hope you believe I'm a serious person. And other people who are very rational have reported to me hearing voices and seeing things, getting a sense of the presence of someone. It may be all psychologically induced because of need and the hunger for the person, but I don't have a problem with it. As long as they feel it. I don't try to instill this. By the way, you can go talk to your dad. Everything will be fine. I mean, I don't talk like that. But I've seen evidence of it. It's not a lot. I mean, in the majority of cases, everything is just quiet and people grieve. But I saw it with my own father. I need to elaborate. But I got a message from him, definitely about 2 days after he died. And the message told me, he was saying, it was not audible, I'm okay. And it could very well be something I just needed so badly to hear and to see, because he came in the form of little lights. But it sure helped me at that moment. It really did. And again, I do think we do not know what happens after death. That's why there's separation. I tell you, God forbid we found out what goes on after death. We'd be a mess. There'd be a fight for dominion of this process, how to exploit the process, and so forth. There's got to be this mystery. That's very important, because it focuses us on our inner needs, our prayer, and our love for someone, rather than a sideshow.
And of course, you know, the one reality that we all know will experience is death. So coming to find a way to do that in a healthy, meaningful way is a very powerful lesson. I want to thank Rabbi Ben Kamen for his visit here on Two Jewish. The book is called The Blessing of Sorrow, Turning Grief into Healing. Where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, I have a website, and it's very simple. It's benkamen.com, B-E-N-K-A-M as in Michael, I-N, like in Nancy, benkamen.com. There is an Amazon page for me and all my books, including this one. So it's readily access about me, information about me, and the books I've written, particularly this new one, are readily available on the internet. And it's a good place to start.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be Stephen Hartoff, author of the new novel, The Soul of a Thief, a fascinating book by a really interesting author about a mischling, a mixed-race, partially Jewish German who serves in the Nazi military during World War II. Don't miss it or him. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website, where you can hear our top 10 in America, American Jewish podcast. Our playout this morning comes from emerging Israeli singer El Chai, his beautiful new release, Merim Neshamot, Illuminating Souls. El Chai composed and wrote the song during his recent army service in the Givati division. It's about the small, personal moments that give life real meaning. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
לחולות מנגנים מנגינות מאירים נשמות מאירים מאירים נשמות מאירים נשמות. שירת הלווים חוזרים לחולות מנגנים מנגינות מאירים נשמות חוזרים לחולות מנגנים מנגינות מאירים נשמות.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.